The second case for oral argument is Diana Hicks versus Gabriel Vaughn School District. For the appellant, Diana Hicks, is Scott Swear, an attorney from Yankton. And for the appellee, Gabriel Vaughn School District, is Gerald Kaufman, an attorney from Huron. Mr. Swear, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Scott Swear, and I represent the appellant in this case, Diana Hicks. This is a teacher non-renewal case. And before the court this morning are two primary issues. The first issue is whether the Gabriel Vaughn Board of Education acted arbitrarily, capriciously, and abused its discretion in non-renewing Diana Hicks' teaching contract. We submit to the court that the board did act arbitrarily, capriciously, and in abuse of its discretion. The second issue is whether the Gabriel Vaughn Board and administration followed all of the requirements of South Dakota's continuing contract law. Again, we submit that the board and the administration did not follow these procedural requirements. Specifically, that the board and the administration did not follow various school handbook policies. Because of that, Your Honor, we're asking the court to reverse the board and the trial court's decision in this case and order Ms. Hicks' reinstatement. As a quick factual background, Diana Hicks taught at the Gabriel Vaughn School for 10 years. There's no question that she was what's called a continuing contract law or tenured teacher under South Dakota law. During her 10 years, she taught primarily physical education, social studies, and health classes. For the 2000-2001 school year, Diana taught middle school, health and social studies, and kindergarten through eighth grade physical education. In the spring of 2001, the Gabriel Vaughn School CEO, Jason Selchert, recommended non-renewal of Diana's tenured teaching contract. As a tenured teacher, Diana requested a hearing before the board, and that hearing was held on May 24, 2001. Approximately a week later, on June 1st of 2001, the board asked Diana to come back in front of the board for an informal hearing. She accepted that request, and on June 11th, she did go back before the board. Later that evening, the board, on a 3-to-1 vote, voted to terminate Diana's tenured teaching contract. That board decision was appealed to the circuit court in Yankton County.
Was that the meeting at which they gave her an opportunity to resign if she would?
Yes, Your Honor. That was the meeting where they gave her...
That was prior to the vote, right?
Yes. After that meeting, they went into executive session later that night and made the vote on a 3-to-1 vote.
So how long did they give her to think about whether or not she'd be willing to resign? Just on the spot?
Yes. And I believe the record shows that everybody agrees that was about a 10 or 15 minute hearing. That was also the hearing that the board brought out some evidence that was not contained in the certified record that was put together back in the formal hearing in May.
Was her attorney present with her?
At the June 11th hearing?
Yeah.
Yes, I was there, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. That board decision...
Sorry, are you alleging that anything that occurred in that executive hearing was prejudicial to your client?
I'm alleging that one thing, Justice Zinchin, was prejudicial there. The fact that during that informal hearing on June 11th, evidence was brought forward by the school board president, Ms. Freeberg. Evidence mainly was that there was a piece of paper that Diana's husband wrote asking the board for her hearing, is what it was. That was not put together in a very professional manner. The grammar in that request was not very well done. At this informal hearing on June 11th, the board said, this is one of the reasons why we are not going to probably renew your contract, because this notice and this request was done very unprofessionally. Well, the record shows that Diana didn't even author that notice and that request. That was done by her husband.
Did she see it before it was done? Did she see it while her husband was doing it?
I think, Your Honor, she did see it before her husband actually presented that to the superintendent.
Why didn't she correct it?
Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think that she's a 10-year, fully tenured teacher who's just been told that she's going to be fired, possibly.
Is he a teacher? Does he have an educational background equivalent?
Her husband?
Yes.
He is not a teacher. He works for a plumbing and heating company in Yankton.
But your client's a Phi-Ed teacher, not an English or a Lit teacher, right?
Yeah, she's a physical education, a health, and social studies teacher.
Now, that document was not one of the stated reasons for the termination, correct?
No, that's right, Your Honor. That's right. So, Your Honors, after that board decision, this decision was appealed to the circuit court. The circuit court affirmed the board's decision. That resulted in this appeal to this court. The first issue, Your Honors, that I'd like to discuss this morning is actually the second issue in our brief. That's the procedural issue. Did the administration and the board follow all of the procedural requirements of South Dakota's continuing contract law? In 1994, this court wrote in Iverson versus the Wall School District that school board policy has the force of law. Therefore, school boards have to comply with their own policies. Similarly, in 1980, in Schnabel versus Alcester School District, the court wrote that policies, rules, and regulations that are adopted by the school board are as binding as if they're statutes enacted by the legislature. So these school policies are just like statutory enactments by our legislature. We submit to this court that the board and the administration did not follow these procedural requirements, specifically that the policy manual was either ignored entirely or simply not followed in terminating Diana's teaching contract. I'd like the court to note a couple aspects of this policy. In the hearing transcript, CEO Selchert, when questioned about why these school policies weren't followed in non-renewing Diana's contract, he said this. He said, number one, I didn't write the policy. And secondly, he said that the content of the policy manual are just numbers to him. They're just numbers to him. This is despite the fact that as the CEO of the school, it's his responsibility, along with the board, to make sure that his school policies are followed. But yet he says that, again, he didn't write the policy and that the contents were really just numbers to him.
But you have a corresponding obligation to show that there's some prejudice to your client if the policy wasn't followed. I mean, it's not a game of gotcha.
Sure, and I understand that, Justice Gilbertson. And here's how I analogize that. I analogize that to a statute of limitations argument. For all practical purposes, there really isn't a difference if someone is served with a summons and complaint one day before the statute of limitations expires or one day after. But we have rules.
But that's jurisdictional. Are you suggesting that the board loses jurisdiction to non-renew a teacher simply because it doesn't follow, sends a notice out by certified rather than registered mail?
Chief Justice Gilbertson, I'm not asserting that at all. What I am asserting is that we have rules for a purpose. The school board in Gayville decided to take the time to make a school policy handbook. Those policies were important. The policies weren't followed. And what we run into is a situation where the administration and the board, in this case, simply picked and chose what policies and what rules and regulations they wanted to follow. So, Your Honor, and as I'm going to talk about here briefly, we think that, number one, the rules were broken. No doubt about that. We also feel that there was prejudice to Diana because these rules were not followed.
Do you intend to itemize for us the specific policies that did, in fact, prejudice your client or interfere with her ability to improve? I need to know, in a summary fashion, which policies in particular you claim have a prejudicial impact.
Yes, Justice Inter. The first policy manual violation that we're alleging is prejudicial here is found at the policy manual on page 117. That policy manual says that no comparisons will be made at the non-renewal hearing with other teachers. The transcript shows very evidently that this rule was violated numerous times. Comparisons were made with Diana and other staff members. I think if the court looks at the hearing transcripts on pages 14, page 21, and page 51, it's interesting that after the board made and the administration made these comparisons with other teachers in violation of the policy, that after listening to those comparisons throughout that entire evening, the one time that Diana tried to make a comparison to defend herself, the one time she tried to make a comparison with other teachers, she was immediately stopped. And the hearing examiner, who was also serving as the board's attorney, said this. He said that we're not here to go into other staff members. It's not relevant to these proceedings. Despite the fact that for the first two or three hours of that hearing, numerous comparisons were made with other faculty members. But the one time that Ms. Hicks tried to make a comparison to defend herself, she was not allowed to do that. The second policy manual violation that we're alleging is found at page 102 of the manual.
And that says, for a minute,
yes,
how did the comparisons that you claim the board made to other teachers harm her?
I think it showed, number one, Your Honor, obviously that was a violation of the policy. Number two...
No, but I'm just addressing it to harm, to prejudice.
Yeah. Justice Sabres, because the rules of the hearing were that those comparisons could not be made, and we knew that going in, we did not prepare in any way to have anyone else there at the hearing to talk about how other staff members were treated or how other staff members went about their duties as compared to Diana.
Is there anything in the board's findings of fact where they rely on this ill-gotten evidence to make their decision?
Yes, Justice Gilkerson,
What's
there
it
are.
Say?
It says that, let me remember the transcript here. The board said, like for the self-evaluations, there was a complaint that Diana did not complete self-evaluations for a couple years. All right? The comparisons were made then with the other staff members. And what was said by middle school principal Fargo was that, well, all of the other teachers did these self-evaluations, but Diana didn't do these self-evaluations.
Is that a fair reading of the policy, though? I would assume they mean you can't say, well, she's a rotten teacher, because if you look at how this English teacher is doing, Miss Jones, the English teacher, is doing A, B, and C, and your client's not. Mm-hmm. Isn't it a fair inference to say that everybody else is following another board policy and your client isn't?
I think that is a fair inference, Your Honor, but again, that was done in violation of the rules that we thought we were going to be playing under.
But that's not a comparison. I mean, I think Justice Gilbertson's point is that's not really a comparison. They said, this is the rule, people follow it, but Diane didn't follow it. Mm-hmm. That's not really a comparison, on fine points where somebody else, where she's being hauled on the carpet for... for missing points A, B, C, D, E, whatever. Do you consider that really a comparison?
I do consider that a comparison, Justice Sabres, I do. And again, this goes back to the fact that this court has never held that when we're dealing with a tenured teacher, that prejudice of some type has to be held. The court has held that in cases where we're talking about a non-tenured probationary teacher. But I don't think that prejudice has ever been the standard when it comes to policy manual violations or legal violations.
Well, wait a minute. You've got it. Go ahead.
Do you have a case where we've reinstated a teacher because there was a policy violation that produced no prejudice?
Your Honor, no, I do not. I don't have a case, but I don't think the court has ever said definitively that prejudice has to be shown when these policy manual violations occur when we're dealing with a tenured continuing contract law teacher.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, you can follow up. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled, these are the seminal cases, that the purpose of a tenure law is to protect a property right.
Right.
Okay. If there's no prejudice to the property right, we're just spinning our wheels for the heck of it?
No, I don't.
Gotcha?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I think that in this case, if the court does find that The standard is we have to show prejudice. I think that with these policy manual violations, that when you look at them in the circumference of them all, and when you look at them together, that those manual violations in this case do constitute prejudice to Diana. Another example of the prejudice is one of the policy manual violations says that formal evaluations have to be signed and dated by both the administration and the teacher. In this case, the formal evaluation was not signed and dated by both the administration and Ms. Hicks. The prejudice there is that the reason that the signature is required is not to show that Diana agrees with the evaluation. It's to show that the administrator and the teacher actually went over her evaluation and that recommendations for improvement were made and they actually talked about the evaluation. In this case, the evidence shows that at no time did Mr. Selcher ever try to talk to Diana about the evaluation or how to make improvements or how to be a better teacher. That never happened.
What was his explanation for that, if he had one?
His explanation, Your Honor, was that he admits that he failed to do this. He knew that there was a policy which required this. He simply didn't do it. And that was his explanation for why that didn't get done. That was his total explanation.
Just that he didn't do it.
He didn't do it.
He gave no reason other than that?
He gave no reason. And again, I'd reference the court back to what Mr. Selcher said about these policies. Again, that the contents in the policies were just numbers to him. And that he didn't write the policy. And that's what he said.
Well, the record indicates that your client received the evaluation, whether it was signed and dated or not. There's no question she knew what the deficiencies were that the CEO was alleging.
Yes, she did receive that, Your Honor. That was placed in her mailbox, just as interest.
So how could she be prejudiced if she knew what they claimed were deficiencies?
Because she was never given an opportunity to go in and talk about those deficiencies with the administration.
She couldn't have taken the form in and said, Mr. Principal, I'd like to visit with you about this. You've got some criticism. What can I do to clean up my act?
She could have, Your Honor, yes. Under the plan of assistance, however, that she was under, the plan of assistance required Mr. Selcher to do a few things. Number one, it was to coordinate all available resources under that plan of assistance. Number two, it was his duty, it was his responsibility to monitor her progress and to do everything possible to make sure that she complied with that plan of assistance. Now, some of that burden is on Diana, no doubt about it. She has to comply with that plan of assistance. And what we're submitting to the court is she complied with that plan of assistance. She did everything possible under that plan of assistance to comply with what Mr. Selcher wanted. And at the end, Mr. Selcher simply said, well, I'm still going to recommend non-renewal, even though she did everything possible under that plan of assistance. And when the court looks at Diana's exhibits 1A through, I think it's 2B, you'll see that everything under that plan of assistance she was required to do was done, and it was done very well.
Did he ever meet with her face-to-face on any of these plans or?
Under the plan of assistance, Justice
yes.
Meyer-Henry? No. In fact, the one time that Diana went in, approximately a week after the plan of assistance started, she went into Mr. Selcher and asked, how do my lesson plans look? How am I doing? And his response was, I'm too busy, I haven't even had time to look at them. After that, Diana did not go in again to ask Mr. Selcher about that. Mr. Selcher never came to her to talk about how she was doing under that plan of assistance.
Was there anyone else in the school system that talked to her about her deficiencies? Or
not while she was on that plan of assistance.
And is that one of the procedures that you're saying they did not follow?
Yes. That they did not follow the procedures of the plan of assistance. That plan of assistance and the way that plan of assistance is supposed to be carried out is right in the policy manual. The plan is part of the policy manual. That was not followed in this case. It was not followed in this case. Because of that, Your Honor, because of the fact that, again, these school policies, as this court said, are as binding as if they were statutes enacted by the legislature. We're asking the court to find that these continuing contract law provisions and the policies were not followed. And because of that, we're asking the court to reinstate Diana along with her proper allocation of back pay and benefits. The second issue before the court, and I see I don't have much time left, is whether the board was arbitrary, capricious, and abused its discretion in making its decision. Again, I'd ask the court to look at the transcript, to look at the testimony of middle school principal Fargo and CEO Selchert, to rely especially on the email of November 30th of 2000 that sets out Mr. Selchert's educational philosophy.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from you again later. Thank you. Mr. Kaufman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court, counsel. Yes, my name is Gary Kaufman, and I represent the Gabriel Vollen School District in this matter. And it's the district's position that the board decision is substantiated by the record. There's competent, credible, relevant evidence within the record, specifically the board hearing transcript. That board hearing lasted approximately five and a half hours. That there's relevant, competent, credible evidence in that record to support the board's decision that was then reiterated or encompassed, I guess, if you will, or identified is a better way to say it, as it relates to the board finding the facts and as the circuit court subsequently upheld on appeal.
What about this fact that all of these plans of assistance, they never sat down and talked to her about?
Your Honor, I would say that that goes to the issue of credibility and dispute within the record. On a board transcript page 80 and pages 201 and 202. Mr. Selcher did identify, did indicate, did testify under oath at the board hearing that he did sit down and talk with Ms. Hicks about that plan of assistance and about the evaluations. And the reason I say it goes to the issue of credibility, Your Honor, is because in Hicks' brief, she argues that, and one of the procedural things I think it was, that she wasn't aware of what was expected of her. While on cross-examination during the board hearing, I specifically asked her, she was specifically asked, did you receive the plan of assistance? Yes. Did you go through it? Yes. I mean, this is all paraphrased. Did you understand what was expected in it? Yes. Did you have any questions about what was expected? No. That is in the board hearing transcript. There was a credibility. Again, we're talking about, there was a previous reference to that April 9 request for a hearing that came up at the court evidentiary hearing on this matter. On page 139 of the transcript, not talking new evidence here, there was a reference in the transcript, the board hearing transcript, page 139, about that same memo that counsel just referred to. So we were not talking about new evidence. If any new evidence was brought up at that June 11th hearing, Your Honor, it's before the circuit court, it was with respect to the email. The other comment I would make regarding a follow-up question that you asked counsel, was there anybody else that she could have met with? Well, first of all, Selchert testified under oath that he did meet with her and went over it. Second, there was a principal, Nancy Fargo, who was involved in the evaluation process and in the recommendation not renew. She was available. She had been, Nancy Fargo, the principal, had been Mrs. Hicks' evaluator in previous years, in the late 90s. And so there were other people around. If she had any question whatsoever regarding what was expected.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying they were around and available? Or are you saying that they followed the policy and did sit down with her? I took you to say the CEO did that. But are you also saying that Fargo did that?
No, there's nothing in the record, Your Honor, that indicate that Mrs. Fargo sat down and specifically went over the plan of assistance with her. There may be a reference of Mrs. Hicks going to Fargo during that period of time on that issue. But the CEO, Mr. Selcher, did sit down when he did his evaluation review and gave her the plan of assistance. He did sit down and go over it with her, and then that plan of assistance also did indicate that he would be available should she have any questions or anything else.
Why wasn't it signed and dated then?
I can't address that, Your Honor. I honestly do not know why Mr. Seltzer did not do it. I don't know if it was an oversight on his part or what.
Does the record reflect what happened there?
No, the record does not reflect, to my memory, Your Honor, you know, specific reasons why he gave. I know the record specifically does reflect that she testified during the course of the hearing that she did receive it, that she did receive the evaluation, and that she had received the plan of assistance.
She claims that she did everything under the plan of assistance. What was the record, what was the record testimony by Selkert in that respect when he claims that he did discuss the plan of assistance with her? And I assume that was after it was finished and after it was, after she claimed that she had, done everything possible, everything required under the plan of assistance.
Your Honor, there were parts of the plan of assistance that were not complied with. The purpose of the plan of assistance was to improve her instruction. There were concerns, Matt, or there were concerns that Mr. Seltzer had regarding her teaching preparation, her teaching strategies, teaching the objectives and the goals of the plan. There's evidence in the record, there's Mr. Seltzer's testimony in the record, that she wasn't teaching the standards, the activities, or the objectives, that she wasn't following the activities or objectives that she herself had developed several years earlier. She wasn't teaching gross motor skills, nor the fine motor skills. Testimony that she was not prepared for class, and this is after after being on the plan of assistance. Testified that it was apparent to him that she was just going out and having the kids do the activity in the PE class, that she wasn't teaching them basic skills, whatever that activity was. She was having them just do the activity. There was not any instruction that he observed going on during those teaching sessions to indicate that she was had any lesson plans, that she was saying, first we're going to do this, we're going to work on this, and then we're going to work on this, and then we're going to work on this, and we're going to tie it all together. That's not what was happening in this situation. He was very concerned, you know, about her lack of improvement, you know, not only during the course of this lesson or plan of assistance, but this is the third plan of assistance that she had been on. Previous administrator in 1995 had noted and indicated concerns, suggestions for improvement. Nancy Fargo, when she was the direct evaluator in 97 or 98, also had very specific concerns. I mean, she testified she was concerned about lesson plans, about what was happening in class, were students being taught goals and objectives, you know, for standards that they were supposed to be being taught in order that students could meet those within those respective programs.
As to the last plan of assistance, does it just come down to a credibility determination between what she says happened and what Selkert says?
I'm pausing, Your Honor, because I think in terms of credibility, what you have here is a school administrator is charged with the responsibility of making sure that a program is being followed, that instructor is following the program. He had put together a plan of assistance. He came to the conclusion that she did not successfully meet that plan of assistance. So if that's a matter of credibility, yes, then you have her saying, I met that plan of assistance, and you have the evaluator who's responsible for the overall daily operation of the school saying it was based upon his conclusion, based upon the plan of assistance, what was expected, what was called for under that plan of assistance, that she did not satisfactorily complete it. I'm not going to stand here and say she didn't complete specific portions, because Seltzer even testified, you know, at that board hearing that there were several things within the plan of assistance that she did do. But bottom line, he came to the conclusion she didn't. The goal of it, again, was to improve her teaching and her teaching methodology and programming, and she was not doing that. And one of the issues within the plan of assistance, you know, were the lesson plans. Mrs. Hicks testified under oath at the board hearing that she thought her lesson plans, generic form, based upon a week, were sufficient. That's not what Fargo wanted in 97 or 98. That's not what Seltzer wanted in the 2000 and 2001, you know, school year and for the plan of assistance. He wanted detailed lesson plans. What are you doing on each day? What are you trying to teach? What activities are you going to do in order to instruct the students on these skills and measurable activities and things of that nature.
Was that written, or how did she know that that's exactly what he wanted? At what point in time was that communicated to her?
That was communicated to her in the plan of assistance itself, both in 97 by Fargo. Her testimony indicated that she had not only said to Hicks that I want detailed lesson plans, but also Fargo's testimony that she discussed those with Mrs. Hicks, and with 2001 plan of assistance, Mr. Selcher indicated on the plan of assistance he wanted detailed lesson plans. He said, he testified under oath that he discussed with her what he meant by that weekly plan of assistance concept was not what he was looking for, was not appropriate. He wanted it broken down on a day-to-day basis. The idea is she's got a defined plan to follow for instructing her students on any given day and where to get the students from goal A to goal B in terms of the program. The other part of the lesson plan, realistically, is if Mrs. Six is going to be gone and have a substitute instructor come in, as compared to, and here's an example of the lesson plans, students will do volleyball. Okay? Well, that's an activity, granted, but where's the instruction going in on that? So you have a substitute teacher even coming in. Is that going to be sufficient for instruction of students? Okay, and Mrs. Six testified at the board hearing. She thought that was sufficient.
Well, how do you respond then to Ms. Hicks' argument that these plans did not include recommendations for improvements or process improvement plans? That's their argument in the brief.
I would just very simply say, Your Honor, that the record does not support that assertion based upon the testimony and the evidence presented at the May 24 hearing, based upon the documentation of the plan of assistance itself in terms of what was expected. She did not comply satisfactorily with that. There were about six or eight, I think, different specific provisions within the plan of assistance that were called for. And it was Selcher's testimony that, again, I think there were two of them, that he said she met those. But when we're talking about the instruction of students being prepared for class, going into a classroom scenario, and having a game plan, if you will, in terms of what she was going to teach the students, she wasn't doing it. Again, as I indicated previously, it was Selcher's testimony that it appeared to him, she was just having the students go out and do the activity. There was not the instruction involved.
How do you answer the allegations here of all of these procedures and that were not followed, that were part of the policies of the district themselves, and the cavalier attitude of the CEO that, not knowing that these policies existed or they weren't his policies? How do you excuse that? I mean, aren't these established to support and direct that due process is followed and that the law is followed and that the teachers know exactly what's expected of them and they're followed up, and then to have not so many of them not followed? How do you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. One comment you made was the concept of due process. And it's the district's position, the board's position, that due process was followed in this case in terms of the notice, in terms of the opportunity to be heard, the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, present your own evidence. So due process, ultimately, is the objective, I would submit, of these policies that Hicks is arguing were violated. It's our position that, albeit there, the evaluation wasn't signed. Okay, that's a given. But was that prejudicial? The answer to that is no. She knew what was, the concern of the administration. She didn't follow it. In terms of the policies, the violations, and Justice Zinter asked, earlier about this, and one was the comparison to teachers. Well, counsel indicated that, the record is replete with examples. Let's submit the records not replete with examples of comparison of teachers. With reference to the comment that the one time that Mrs. Hicks attempted to introduce stuff on a comparison concept, it was objected to, yes, it was. Because the question was,
To Mr. Selcher, are there any teachers on your staff who are not certified to be teaching? That was not relevant to the proceedings. Counsel for the administration, objected that based upon relevancy, and the board attorney upheld that, sustained that objection. There were not objections, on the other aspects by Hicks or her attorney. The other thing about the comparison, Hicks' attorney on direct examination of Hicks asked Hicks if she knew if there was any other teachers in a system who are asked to provide a similar type of detailed lesson plans. That's in board transcript 154. Okay, so when we're talking about comparison of the teachers, Hicks herself was doing that during the course of the hearing. Other examples, in terms of, the 611 meeting, it was one of the examples that Hicks is arguing was a violation of some kind of policy procedure. Well, first of all, there's nothing within board policy procedure that prohibited that. There is nothing within state law that prohibited that. Admittedly, it may be somewhat unusual, but as the board attorney testified in front of Judge Rush, and board attorney Tom Freeberg, he said, it appeared, to him that there were going to be enough sufficient, votes on the board to vote to not renew your contract. The board tried to give her, advance notice of what it looked like is possibly going to be happening. Did she want to, resign at that time? Answer to that was no. There was no request for any kind of time frame, have 24 hours or 40 hours or anything else like that. She indicated no. She did not want to consider that, and so the board went ahead and proceeded. And so as it relates to the procedural violations that are alleged, Your Honor, I would submit that, like with the evaluation, again, there's not prejudice shown. She was not harmed by any of these things that she alleges that, were not 100% consistent with policy. She was provided due process. She knew what the issues were. It was not a first-time scenario for her. Like this court said in Nordhagen, I believe it was, you know what the problems are. You have a responsibility to follow through on those problems. Your failure to do that, counterbalances, if you will, anything, that the board or the administration may have done, inappropriately, as long as it didn't prejudice the teacher. There was no prejudice shown in here whatsoever.
Counsel, were you involved in the Wiest case?
No, I was not, Your Honor.
Okay. How would you distinguish the Wiest case from this case? So is that one of the cases you're relying on?
District, I did not rely on that case to my recollection within the brief, Your Honor. If we did, and here would be the argument, because I know that Hicks relied on it, it would be the district's position that Wiest actually supports affirming the school board decision, circuit court decision in this case, because Hicks on her brief noted on page 2728 that after a teacher had been on the plan of assistance and failed to satisfactorily complete that plan of assistance, a board decision to not renew the teacher's contract is not arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. That's one point. The other point within Wiest, as this court noted, is that the board, after hearing all of this testimony, from two administrators and from Hicks, was in the best situation to judge the credibility of the witnesses. And in this case, again, we got a five and a half hour hearing. The board had ample time to listen to all the evidence, listen to all the witnesses, listen to the cross-examination, and then every one of the three witnesses, Principal Fargo, CEO Selcher, even Hicks. After each one, the board, along with board's attorney, Mr. Freeberg, took a short recess. They came back, and in every one of those situations, the board asked at least one question of every one of the witnesses. The board was taking this role very, very seriously. Realistically, I think it is even shown by the initial vote to adopt CEO Selcher's recommendation on 4-9 of 01. It was a 5-0 vote.
When the board ultimately made its formal decision after the board hearing on June 11 of 2001, it was a 3-1 vote. One board member was not present at the board hearing, and therefore abstained from deliberations and discussion and vote. And so the board did take the whole thing very, very seriously. They were weighing everything. They met on the hearings on May 24. They met again on May 31 to discuss this. They did not come to a conclusion at that point in time, you know, and then they met again on June 11th.
Did she ever challenge by witnesses or by any evidence that she was not a substandard teacher, but that she was an excellent teacher who deserved to maintain her tenure? Did she ever call any witnesses to that effect, or did she ever present any evidence along those lines in a positive light for herself?
She called no witnesses on her behalf other than her own testimony. Okay, and the thrust of her testimony, I would submit, was that I complied with the plan of assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Swear, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd like to focus for a few minutes on Mr. Kaufman's assertion that there was credible and competent evidence to non-renew Mrs. Hicks. The purpose of continuing contract law is to provide teachers with security in employment and to prevent dismissal without cause. And in this case, Your Honor, when you look at some of the court's previous decisions, I don't think that the evidence presented here constitutes the type of just cause that is the hallmark of teacher tenure. Now, I'm not saying that every teacher, once they attain tenure, can simply do what they want and they can't be touched. That's not what I'm asserting. But tenure law does provide teachers security and employment. And I'd like to just very briefly look at the evidence that was relied upon by the board. The board first heard from middle school principal Fargo. Miss Fargo's main concern with Diana was that she was, quote, coaching the fundamentals of basketball and not teaching the fundamentals of basketball. That was her main concern about why Diana shouldn't be renewed, because she was coaching the fundamentals of basketball and not teaching the fundamentals. I don't think that that type of statement justifies the cause needed to fire and to end the career of a long-time tenured teacher. The board then heard from CEO Selchuk, and there are two factors I'd like the court to keep in mind when evaluating this testimony. First is that Mr. Selchuk was just completing his first year as CEO at Gabriel Mullen. And until he was challenged on this issue, he always referred to himself as the superintendent. Until he was challenged at the hearing and he finally admitted that he didn't have the qualifications, the education, or the certification to be a superintendent. Otherwise, he always held himself out to the public and on the school documents as superintendent. He wasn't a superintendent. He wasn't qualified to be a superintendent. The second factor that I'd like the court to consider is that November 30th, 2000 email. That email outlines Mr. Selchuk's philosophy of education. And this is the philosophy that he used in dealing with Diana through her evaluations and through her plan of assistance.
You know, we've all read the briefs, and so we've seen that email, and I'm not prohibiting you from going into it, but it seems to be missing the point a little bit. I mean, I think that you've, you know, pretty persuasively castigated Selkert for what he did by act or by omission. But it doesn't seem to me that your arguments really go to the positive aspects for your client, or say that the board's decision was in fact arbitrary. Maybe he appeared a little bit arbitrary, especially taking, you know, your brief and your evidence that you accentuate. But I don't know that you've established, you know, any arbitrary, capricious activity on the part of the board. You know, or, and one more thing, I think that There was no evidence, but, you know, and I realize a tenured teacher is, you know, is basically presumed to be competent for starters, but it seems like the record almost begs for one or two or three other teachers from the school system or parents of students who say, you know, who support her and the merits of her position. But the record is completely lacking with that, except for her own testimony, isn't it?
I think, Your Honor, her testimony, and I think also, when you look at what she did under that plan of assistance, when you look at the work in the exhibits that we presented, which shows what she did under that plan of assistance, not only was she teaching six or seven courses every single day, but she was also under this plan of assistance, which required her to file reports on teaching methods, on things like Bloom's taxonomy, on everything else that Mr. Selcher asked her to do. She did it. That right there, I think, Justice Saber, shows that this is a competent teacher. She did everything that was asked of her under this plan of assistance. That shows competency right there. Also, the fact that she was granted tenure by this school, and for year after year after year, for a decade, the school found that she was a competent, good teacher. I think that in itself, Justice Saber, shows that this is a positive, good teacher.
Did they actually put down in writing or say she was a good, competent teacher, or did they simply rehire her?
Well, they rehired her, Your Honor, each and every year. As the record shows, there were some years when the administration didn't even follow its evaluation policy. So there are a few years where Diana doesn't even have administrative evaluations. It was supposed to be done, and it was not done. So there's nothing in the record to show if she was evaluated highly or not highly. The one evaluation in the record is the evaluation that was done on March 28th of 2001 by Mr. Selcher. And that's when he says things like, well, her objectives are vague. He didn't like where she placed some of the basketballs in the gym during gym class. Things like that. When the court looks at the record and it looks at what Mr. Selcher relied upon to justify this non-renewal, and that evidence was presented to the board, again, that evidence simply does not comply with the fact that teachers have a right to security and employment. And when you look at the board's decision and what they relied upon, that decision is arbitrary, capricious, and an abuse of discretion. And if the court finds that what Mr. Selcher relied upon to non-renew Mrs. Hicks is good evidence and is competent evidence, then really, I don't think I'm making an overstatement here. Teacher tenure law in South Dakota really becomes a hollow joke. It really becomes a hollow joke. Again, I'm not saying that every teacher, once they're tenured, has a lifetime right to that job. But when you look at what Mr. Selcher had in his complaints about Diana, that is not competent, credible evidence. And I think the court has to look also, again, at Mr. Selcher's educational philosophy. And as Justice Saber said, I know the court is aware of that philosophy. His philosophy in that email was that school is like war. If you're not following in my direction, your head is the first to get chopped off. That was his philosophy. That's what he outlined to his faculty as his philosophy of education. And that's the philosophy that was used in, number one, ignoring his policy manual, the manual that he was supposed to uphold. He was the person at the school who was supposed to make sure that his school board's policies and rules and regulations were upheld. He didn't do that. He didn't do that. And he admits throughout the transcript that he didn't do that. And his philosophy, again, was that, well, I didn't write the policy, or the contents of the policy are just numbers to me. I think that very directly shows what Mrs. Hicks was up against throughout this plan of assistance. And no matter what she did under that plan, and she did everything that was required under her, no matter what she did, there was going to be a non-renewal recommendation, and there was going to be testimony to non-renew Ms. Hicks. Because of that, Your Honor, again, we're asking the court Number one, to find that the procedural requirements of continuing contract law were not followed by the board and the administration. And number two, a close review of the record shows that the competent evidence relied upon by the board was not competent. That's not the type of just cause that constitutes the ability for school boards to fire tenured teachers. If we were dealing with a probationary or a non-tenured teacher, I wouldn't have a very good argument in front of this court. But there are certain protections in place for tenured teachers. They weren't followed here. The evidence itself was not credible. It wasn't competent. And the board acted arbitrarily, capriciously, and abused its discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swear. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.